filmy ring formed around the inside of the mug. Most days on summer vacation, Pearl had gone over to a friend's house to swim in their pool, or shop for cheap earrings at the mall, or imitate dance moves from YouTube videos. But today, she didn't want to go anywhere. Her stomach felt sour with nerves. She poured herself a bowl of Cheerios and added milk. Carrying it into the living room, she set it down on the coffee table and switched on the TV from the couch, flicking through channels until she came to a show she recognized. Hemlock, Vampire Bounty Hunter. All the neighborhood kids had been super into Hemlock when they were younger. For the last three whole summers, Pearl had played bounty hunters and vampires with them, running through backyards with a branch in her hand, holding it up like a stake. She'd even dressed up like Hemlock one Halloween, although Mike Chavez told her that it wasn't a good costume for a girl. But in the last year, Hemlock had been on at the same time as another show that she liked better, so she hadn't seen any of the new episodes. And this summer, boys and girls didn't play with each other anyway. But right then, the familiarity of the show was reassuring, so she left it on. "The thing about vampires," Hemlock said from his equipment room, strapping stakes carved from rosewood and hawthorn onto a bandolier, their tips capped with plastic so they didn't go blunt during travel. "They're all messed up in the head. They're hungry all the time. We gotta think like they do, think like predators, and outsmart them at their own game. They might be faster and stronger, but we're still human, and that's what makes us better. That's what counts." The show cut to him sitting in his truck with his assistant, Gina. She was drinking from a big gulp, in white jeans and a cut-off shirt studded with rhinestones, her hair teased so big that it hit the roof. They were parked in front of a strip club, loud music pumping from the speakers. A rerun, Pearl realized. An okay one, but not super great.
"We think we've spotted her inside that building," Gina said in her exaggerated camera-friendly whisper. "There's a door around back, so we're going to have to get one of us on either side of the building and see if we can't flush her out."
Before he started vampire hunting, Hemlock used to be a wrestler. He quit, although some people say he was thrown out of the league, after an opponent died in the ring. Pearl knew all this from the Hemlock fan club she joined when she was 9, around the same time that Hemlock started going on talk shows and telling the story, weeping as he explained that the death of that man was the moment he realized he needed to change his life. Looking at the screen, Pearl wondered for the first time if the vampire was scared. Before, she'd always figured that good vampires went to one of the cold towns, or some place they were supposed to be, and that bad vampires stayed behind to attack people. But now that it was Aiden, who'd always been nice to her, and her big sister, Tana, out in the world, sick or newly turned, she couldn't think of things that way anymore. Of course, there were bad vampires, like the ones who'd killed those kids in Tana's class. Maybe the vampire that Hemlock was hunting was like that. But how could he tell? Back on the show, Hemlock was getting extra supplies out of the back of his truck.
"There's three ways to kill a vampire and be sure it's dead," Hemlock said. "You put wood through its heart, you set it on fire, or you chop off its head. Anything else is fighting a gunslinger with an open-handed slap. Of course, some people stand by bleeding them out, but to me, that's like a silver nail in the head. Might hold them for a while, but it ain't permanent."
"And don't forget sunlight, baby,"
said Gina, zipping herself into a chainmail shark suit.
"Sunlight sure kills them."
He rolled his eyes. This was a big part of the show, the relationship between the two of them.
"Nobody looking to kill a vampire is gonna be like, oh yeah, I guess I better get out some sunlight. That's no weapon."
"It kills them," she tossed her hair. "That's all I'm saying. Kills them good."
He grunted and picked up a clear bottle, screwing off the top.
"Now, some of you have been asking about which holy waters or wild rose waters to use on steaks, or why I use holy water at all, since there's been a whole bunch of hubbub about how it doesn't really do anything. Well, first of all, I always use oil, not water, because it seeps into the wood better and stays there. And I use rose oil that's been blessed, so that's double duty. And for all you people who say holy whatever doesn't help take down vamps, I'm out here in the field, so who you gonna believe, me or some scientists? Leaving that question hanging in the air, he hefted up a giant crossbow, its body carved into a crucifix. Now, another common viewer question is which of my weapons is my favorite? A wooden stake sat cocked and ready in place of a quarrel. That's this baby. She can drop a vampire from 30 feet.
It's time to start killing,
Gina said, tapping a white ceramic watch. He smiled at the camera.
Okay, let's roll.
Pearl felt along the couch for the controller. They were almost to the part where the vampire came out from the bar. There was a chase after that, and Gina almost got bit on the arm, but her chain bodysuit protected her. Hemlock wound up shooting the vampire with the crossbow and sawing off her head for the bounty. Pearl didn't want to see it. Not right then. After all the stuff the police had said about her sister. Not when her dad had come back from the hardware store with wild rose vines for the lentils and a big blowtorch he didn't explain. She clicked off the television and opened her laptop, booting up the feed for Lucien Moreau's party. Her dad hated that she watched stuff like this, where the vampires weren't portrayed like villains, but today she didn't care. She brought another spoonful of cereal to her mouth as the inside of his mansion came on the screen. It looked like something out of a fairy tale, with its gold damask wallpaper and candles on sconces jutting out from the walls. Elizabeth, Lucien's consort, was on the screen, her beautiful dark hair pulled back into a chignon and the front of her dress wet with blood. Her red lipstick made her fangs seem even brighter when she smiled. Lucien Moreau, elegantly dressed in cream, his hair like spun gold, caught her up in his arms, whirling her around. His mouth was stained equally bright when he brought it to hers. Pearl smiled. That was where her sister was going. Tana was going to live like that, like a princess in a faraway city. Maybe, someday, Pearl could even join her. And once she did, she just knew that everything would be perfect forever. Chapter 21. Dying is a wild night and a new road. Emily Dickinson. When Tana woke, the sky overhead was just beginning to darken. She could smell onions frying and heard music playing. People shouted to one another on the street, laughter in their voices. All the kind of stuff she might have expected to find in every city except this one. Aiden was sleeping beside her, his jaws slightly apart. She stretched, feeling the stiffness of her muscles. She was still groggy and for a moment imagined putting her head down and just sleeping on and on. But if Aiden opened his eyes and saw her like that, all curled up and delicious, like a blood-filled muffin, she doubted he'd resist biting. She pushed herself to her feet. The more she remembered where she was and what had happened, the more fear pushed away the last dregs of drugged lethargy. Her purse was still slung across her body, and she unclasped it, pushing aside everything that wasn't the small manila envelope. Panic sped up her heart and made her almost too afraid to look. But the marker was still there, tucked away safe. No one had taken it. For a moment, she actually thought nice things about midnight and winter. They might not care if she died, but at least they hadn't robbed her. She held the marker up to the light. Just a little larger than a quarter and even lighter than one, it was terrifying to think that this gleaming coin, this object that was supposed to save her life, was small enough to drop through a drain by accident or slip through a hole in a pair of jeans. Bright silver with gold at the heart where the circuits were, surrounded by small, angled cutouts in the metal, it looked like nothing so much as an old-fashioned subway token. She closed her hand into a fist over it, tight, then put it away. She went over the rest of her inventory. She had the clothes on her back, her boots from home, and her handbag. that held the religious symbols and rosewater she'd found at the party, a random assortment of cash rolled up in a brown paper bag, and the garnet locket with the broken clasp that Gabriel had given her in the parking lot. At the thought of him, she pressed her tongue absently against her teeth, making the bite there sting anew. It throbbed along with the beat of her heart, drumming in her ears. When she realized what she was doing, shame heated her face. It was bad enough she'd kissed him like that, but it was the same impulse as hitting the gas on an icy road, and she couldn't let herself forget it. He wasn't going to save her. He didn't even know where she was, no less that she needed saving. They weren't going to sneak out of Cold Town to have mad, bad adventures together, where he recited lots of poetry and they visited Pauline at drama camp. If he liked her in some strange, savage way, it wasn't the way humans liked one another, and it wasn't the way people in storybooks liked one another either. "Stop being stupid," she told herself, even though it was much too late for that. She'd been 100 kinds of stupid already. "Tana." Aiden rolled over on the mattress. His face was gentle with sleep, his hair messy, but his eyes watched her with a disturbing intensity. He slowly shifted into a sitting position, and she noticed that his lips had taken on a blue tint. He gave a long, shuddering sigh. It was almost 40 hours since he'd been bitten, and he was looking ever worse as the hours ticked by.
"What do you think Rufus and Midnight and those other psychos are going to do now?"
"Wait," she said grimly, and after a moment, he seemed to realize what she meant. She said it again, though, just to be sure.
"They're going to wait."
"I won't," he began, then stopped himself. The words were hollow anyway. They both knew he would. "Don't worry about it. We're going to get out of here," she told him, although there was a flatness to her tone. Even she wasn't sure she believed it. Leaning back against the wall, he didn't seem ready to attack her yet, but she wondered how long she had. He was still just waking up.
"Haven't you ever thought about it? Being a vampire?" he asked.
"Everybody's thought about it," said Tana.
"I mean, what with your mom and all?"
He stopped abruptly, as though he'd just realized he'd stumbled into dangerous territory. He gave her one of his old, charming half-smiles, a teasing one.
"And you kissed a vampire? That's crazy. That's not usually what they do with their mouths, you know. I'm kind of jealous."
"Oh, come on," she said, rolling her eyes. "Like you care what I do. You dumped me, remember?"
"First of all," Aiden said,
giving her his most insouciant smile and holding up a single finger.
"I never said I was jealous of him. Maybe I was jealous of you for getting all his attention. He's not a bad-looking guy, if you don't mind a side serving of lunatic raving. Good mouth."
That made her laugh, a real, relaxed laugh like in the old days.
"Secondly," he said, holding up another finger, "you scared the hell out of me when we were dating, Tana. I was used to having girlfriends who'd yell at me or get upset about the stupid stuff I did or try to save me from myself. You weren't like that. Sometimes I felt like you were a better me than I was."
"I didn't know what we were doing a lot of the time," she protested. "I didn't even..." There was a rustling sound at the door, cutting off her words. A girl's hand snaked through the plastic flap, a dozen silver rings on her fingers, and fresh, glossy green polish on her nails. She was holding a wooden bowl, a bowl filled so full of red liquid that setting it down caused some to spatter over the floorboards, sinking into the grooves of the wood. The scent of it was iron and basements, and losing baby teeth so her big girl teeth could come in. It was skinned knees and Gabriel's mouth on hers. It was smeared walls and staring eyes. Tana scrambled to her feet. Blood. For a long moment, she and Aiden looked at the bowl. Tana felt hypnotized by the sight of it. The slick redness was as dark and deep as a pool of melted garnets. If she drank it, she would turn into a monster. She let herself imagine that for a moment, imagining her new monster body and monster eyes and monster thirst. She imagined Midnight and Winter, Rufus and Christabel and Zara opening the door to the room and finding a monster girl inside. And if she didn't drink and Aiden did, he would die and wake again, newly turned, ravenous, and alone with her. "See?" An unfamiliar girl's voice came from the other side of the door, probably Christabel or Zara. "We don't want anyone to get hurt. We didn't want to have to lock you up. We donated that blood, all of us together. Pulled it out of our veins with needles. And now we can't go to the clubs tonight, but see? We're worthy. Drink it and you can come out of the little room. Drink it and we'll all be friends again." Thicker than water. That's what people said about blood. It looked it, too. Viscous and syrupy. Tana could imagine the silky texture of it on her tongue, the warm saltiness, how it would stain her lips and teeth. "Maybe we should," Aiden said, his voice going low, seductive and seduced. He took a step toward it. "We could do it together, like a suicide pact. Except we'll never die, Tana." Walking quickly across the floor, her heart hammering, she picked up the bowl and flung it as hard as she could against the wall. The wood cracked, two halves bouncing off the floor where they fell. Bits of plaster rained after it.
"I can't believe you did that,"
Aiden said, in a tone of pure, astonished frustration. He walked toward the wall as though drawn. Tana slumped, sliding down to the floor, where she sat staring at the blood painting the wall. The stain seemed to make a shape like a great bird, feathers dripping down as it flew up into the sky. She couldn't quite believe she'd done it either. "I'm not going to get any better," his voice rose, staring at the red. "I'm so cold, Tana, and I'm only going to get colder." She slammed her hand against the floor, trying to focus her thoughts. "Gabriel let you drink his blood, right? Back at the last stop, and it helped. All we need is more." He laughed, but not as though he thought it was funny. Not as though he thought it was a possibility, either. "The most precious stuff in Cold Town, and you're going to just ask for some? Like you're borrowing a cup of sugar." He reached out a hand to the wall streaked with blood. "Give up. I came knowing I was going to be a vampire. What's the point of waiting? We're not going to be fine, Tana. We're never going to be fine ever again." She wondered what it was like to bite someone. She thought about the expression on Gabriel's face when he'd sunk his teeth into Aiden, the way his mouth had moved on Aiden's throat and his fingers had dug into Aiden's skin. It was as though some serene frenzy had come over him. He looked transcendent, a dreamer not yet awakened. Her stomach clenched just thinking about it, a combination of desire and dread that made her wonder if it was a symptom of the infection. She shouldn't find the memory of that anything but horrific. But putting aside what she should feel, oh yeah, she got why Aiden might be embarrassed at the memory of drinking from Gabriel's wrist. That thought wouldn't leave her head as she watched Aiden brush his fingers over the wall and bring them, painted red now, to his mouth. "Aiden," she said softly, hopelessly, just before he licked them clean, one by one. He made a sound in the back of his throat and knelt down, pressing his lips to the wall, laving it with his tongue. Already he seemed inhuman, a creature feeding instead of a boy she'd known. Tana inched away, putting as much distance between them as the small room would allow. A shaky breath escaped her mouth, sounding like a sob. "Okay," she shouted, her voice coming unsteadily. "Midnight, are you out there? Okay, he did it. He caved. You can let us out now. You can let him out." She heard only the sound of murmuring voices floating up from the rooms below. There was a commercial that ran sometimes on television, especially during daytime soap operas when moms might be watching. It showed chicken nuggets on a plate in front of a human boy, and a blood milkshake in front of a slavering vampire girl tied to her chair with ropes. The human messily gorged on the nuggets in the time the vampire just got started on her milkshake. Then the voiceover guy said, "Shipton's nuggets will make your kid hungrier than a newborn vampire." "The joke's on you," she told herself, remembering. "Nothing is as hungry as a newborn vampire." He was going to die. And before he came back to life as a vampire, if Tana wanted to live, she was going to have to kill him, just like her dad had killed her mom. Kill him before he attacked her with all that new strength. Her best bet was probably the wooden bowl. It was already split in half. Maybe she could chip off a splinter big enough to work like a stake. But just the thought of it, of pressing it into his chest deep enough to puncture his heart, made her sick. Aiden sat down heavily, his back to the blood-stained wall. His lips were red. "I'm sorry," he said miserably, and she couldn't help wondering if he wasn't just apologizing for what he'd done, but for what he would inevitably do. "I'm sorry, Tana." She nodded. "I know. Me too." They sat like that, on opposite ends of the room, watching the river of light move across the floor as early morning stretched into afternoon. Aiden began to shiver, his gaze going again and again to the wall. Occasionally, he would turn to look at her with a wild light in his eyes and then turn away, breathing heavily as though he was in pain. "Think," she told herself. "Think." She got up, pacing the room, forcing herself to look at the trim of the door frames and baseboards, to consider what could be pried loose and used to kill him. Of course, there was another way. If she took a little blood, his still human blood, or blood from the wall, so long as she was infected, she'd change too. "Haven't you ever thought about it? Being a vampire? It would be goodbye, Pearl. Goodbye, Pauline. Goodbye, dream of Los Angeles and palm trees and bright blue ocean. Goodbye, lying on a towel in the backyard under the summer sun, ants crawling across her foot, slippery cocoa butter gleaming on her skin. Goodbye, beating heart and burgers and having blue-gray eyes. Kill Aiden or die herself. Die and rise. We'll never die, Tana." She looked at the wall where the bowl had struck, considering the small hole halfway up the plaster, and had a sudden, desperate thought. Crossing the room, she kicked the blood-soaked wall, just above the baseboard. Even in her steel-tipped boots, her toes hurt, but she cracked the plaster. She kicked again, widening the hole. Maybe she didn't have to make a terrible choice. Maybe she could put off being a monster for another day. "What are you doing?" Aiden said, looking up at her. "I don't know," she said. "It might not work." She walked to where a sharp-looking piece of the bowl had fallen and picked it up. Then she closed her eyes, gritted her teeth, and slammed it midway between the first hole and the dent. Dust coated her skin and clothes. Then, wedging her boot in the first hole, she reached up through the second to the slats, gripped the wood, and started climbing. It was hard to balance, and harder with her foot pressing down, making more plaster crumble, not to slip. And then, hardest of all, to slam the piece of bowl into the wall from that position so that she made another hole and kept climbing. "Tana?" Aiden asked. She looked down, realizing he was standing beneath her. He had a hungry expression on his face. His mouth was slightly apart, his pink tongue pressing against one of his canines speculatively, as if testing it for sharpness. "I think I can make it to the skylight," she said. "Normal. Normal. Keep acting like everything's normal. I'm climbing a wall as if I'm the lamest superhero in the world and you're dying and everything's normal. If the chandelier holds me and if I can actually jump on it." Tana was reminded of a similar exercise they did every year in gym class. Last time, she'd gotten halfway up the climbing wall before jumping off and landing on one of the mats in exhaustion. Pauline, who'd conned an ice pack out of the school nurse for her unhurt wrist so she could sit on the bleachers and avoid the whole thing, had called her a sucker for even trying that hard. Now, she wished she'd tried a lot harder. She wished she'd practiced climbing that wall every day.
"You're going to leave me here?"
he asked her. Tana shifted her weight, muscles straining.
"When I get up onto the roof, I'll see if I can find some way to get you out."
He shook his head, his voice oddly flat. "It's too late for that. I can feel it." There was nothing she could say. His skin was pale enough to be nearly translucent, the flesh around his eyes blue as bruises. She wondered if he could feel his heart slowing, if the catch in his voice was because he was finding it harder to breathe.
"I'll get you out tonight, then, once you're changed," Tana told him.
He didn't answer, just watched her grunt as she pulled herself higher. She wished she were stronger, wished she hadn't woken up exhausted. Sweat started at her brow and her thighs. Her arms burned. She ignored everything and concentrated on not falling. High up the wall, she looked out at the chandelier. What had seemed a short distance to jump from the floor now looked impossible. Beneath her, Aiden paced the floor like some kind of large, hungry cat. If she fell, if she twisted her ankle or broke her leg, she would look a lot like prey. "Jump," she told herself. "Jump." But she was too scared. Looking down, she felt off balance, all her limbs shaking. She didn't think she could do it. Taking a deep breath, she gave herself a little pep talk. Get over your fear of this, or get over your fear of murdering in cold blood someone you care about, because those are your choices. It was, admittedly, a pretty crappy pep talk, but it worked. She jumped. Her legs hit the brass arms of the chandelier, hands grabbing for the central column. She barely made it. One leg hooked over, the other dangling down, fingers flailing for a grip. Her purse strap pulled against her throat. Plaster fell from the ceiling, dusting her in a rain of white. The chain slipped a little, and she slipped too, one of her hands sliding from the chandelier. Her head banged against one of the light bulbs as the whole thing swung dizzily. "It's going to pull free from the ceiling," she thought. "I'm going to fall." Straining with her remaining arm and leg, she tried to heave herself back up. She felt a sharp tug, and the strap of her purse pulled against her throat tight enough to choke. Then, there was a snapping sound, and the leather slid free. Looking down, she realized that Aiden had her purse in one hand, holding it out as if he was proud of himself. He'd bitten the strap.
"Give that back," she yelled. "Why did you—"
"Be careful," he told her, a smile in his voice. "You don't want to fall." He had the marker. But if she let go now, with the chandelier half ripped free from the ceiling, there was no way it would hold her a second time, from a second jump. She had to focus on getting up and getting to that skylight, even if what she wanted to do was cry. Hands shaking and head ringing, she pushed herself back to a more secure position on the chandelier. Every time it hitched lower, she was sure she was going to fall. Every time it swung, she was even more sure she was going to fall. But she managed to get herself into an upright position, one foot balancing on an arm of the chandelier while she stood. Reaching up, shaking and sweaty, she grabbed hold of the lever. The window pivoted inward. A drizzle of dirty water rained down, along with a few leaves.
"Now what?"
Aiden called up. Then he started to cough. She was going to have to pull herself up. It was going to be all arm strength and desperation that got her out, if anything got her out at all. She extended her hands as far as she could and grabbed hold of the sill. Then she launched off the chandelier, scrabbling to get her chest over the edge of the skylight. That moment, when her feet had only air underneath them and she was breathing in gasps, trying to haul herself up. pure terror sparking like acid in her veins, was awful. And when she made it, upper body resting on the tiles of the roof, she stayed that way for a long moment, afraid she was too tired to even pull up her legs. Finally, dragging herself forward, she looked back down at Aiden. The chandelier hung between them on an angle, electrical cords ripped loose from the ceiling. He was grinning. Wow, that was amazing. Panting, exhausted, she said, "Please, please give me my purse back. I don't know why you took it, and I don't care. Just give it to me." "Sorry, Tana," he said, unzipping it and rooting around inside, pulling out the small envelope. With pale, unsteady fingers, he took out the small silver disc with the computer chip center and held it up in the growing light. "I wanted to make sure you have to come back. I'm scared." "I won't leave you here," Tana said, low, looking directly into his eyes, so he could see that she meant what she was promising. "You don't need any proof of that. You know me. I'm crazy. Crazy enough to come back, marker or no marker." "Then it doesn't matter, right?" And he flashed her one of his exasperating puppy dog looks. "I'll give you the rest of the bag. Just let me keep the marker. It's my dying wish."
"Please, Tana. Please."
"No," she said. "Too bad." Aiden closed her bag and threw it to her. She snatched it out of the air, angry, and even angrier that he was giving her something to be grateful for. "You better not lose that marker," Tana said, stomach churning, resigning herself. "You better not give it to some hot kid you want to impress. It's still mine." "I won't," he said, bringing it to his mouth and kissing it with his dried, blood-stained lips. "Come for me after it's dark." Tana rolled onto her back, lying on the roof and looking into the faded blue of the sky. She was exhausted, her mind supplying only the words, "I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired," over and over, a chant that felt more true every time she thought it. She blinked and a shadow fell over her. She sat up to see a Latino boy walking toward her across the peak of the roof. She yelped in surprise. He was the same boy she'd seen that morning. He had short, cropped jet hair, multicolored tattoos snaking up the dark skin of his arms, and bright gold hoops in both ears, but no bird this time. "You okay?" he asked. She nodded. He walked over to the skylight and looked down into it. "They locked you in there with that kid? What's wrong with him?" She nodded. "Aiden's infected. They fed him blood. He's going to turn." The boy shook his head. He seemed piratical enough to fit in with Rufus and Zara and Christabel, and he'd known they were a they, but he hadn't called out to them that morning from the rooftop. She really, really hoped they weren't friends. He stuck out his hand. She took it, letting herself be hauled onto her feet. The gentle slope of the roof made her steps unsteady, but she didn't think she was in any danger of falling unless she tried to go fast. "I saw you," she said, "with the bird." "I live around here," he told her. "Lived here since before the quarantine. It's safer higher up. My name's Jameson." Tana looked around at the sea of rooftops, some connected and some not. "If you show me the way to the street, I'll buy you dinner." "The sun's going down," he said. "They call that meal breakfast around here." She looked up at the clouds, painted with the scarlet and gold of dusk. "Breakfast, huh?" Jameson shrugged, walking toward the peak of the roof. "Welcome to Cold Town. Breakfast at dusk, lunch at midnight, dinner at dawn. And don't expect everyone to be as nice as me. Come on." Hesitating, Tana glanced back at the skylight. "He's dying down there, by himself. Everybody dies alone, Jameson said, and kept going. Not everybody wakes up right after. Come on. After a moment, not knowing what else to do, she followed him. He led her from rooftop to rooftop until they came to a fire escape, which they clanked down noisily. Cold Town was a city running upside down, where day was night and night was day. As they got closer to the town center, the streets filled with shopkeepers and street vendors setting up for the coming night. Kids on torn blankets selling dented canned goods for a quarter apiece called out to her as she passed. There were other makeshift stalls, one full of small generators that ran on solar power and operated by hand crank, another with an array of dresses and coats on racks, and a third with chickens and rabbits in cages. A woman stoked a fire underneath two enormous soup pots, while a man on a stool stirred them furiously. A sign behind the couple promised a ladleful of vegetable broth at half price if you brought your own bowl. A man in a top hat and red suspenders called out gleefully from behind a smoking barbecue grill.
Rat on a stick, better get him quick. Crispy and sweet, meat for a treat.
Tana's stomach growled, but she wasn't sure she could bring herself to eat. She wondered if it was the infection, if it was finally going to steal her hunger for anything other than blood. At that thought, her stomach churned worse than ever. By the time she got to High Street, her head was spinning.
Go grab a seat,
Jameson said, gesturing to a place with small, grubby plastic tables and mismatched chairs.
I'll get us something. You can pay me back.
She wondered what his game was, but since they were in a public place and running off might land her in a weirder or worse situation, Tana sat. He returned a few minutes later with two plates filled with what looked like scrambled eggs with chives, a couple of warm tortillas, and two mugs of black coffee with a film of grounds on top.
Okay, Jameson said. I helped you out, and I bought you food. Now, maybe you could tell me a little bit about the Thorn of Istra.
Tana just stared at him.
How come you think I...
He took out his phone, thumbed a few buttons, and pushed it across the table toward her. She didn't understand what she was looking at for a moment. It was a blog post with a blurry photograph that Tana recognized as the one Midnight had taken with her camera phone. She must have messed around with it in Photoshop before posting, though, because the picture was brighter. Tana and Gabriel's faces were recognizable, tipped toward each other in a moment before their mouths touched. His eyes were closed.
And before you ask why I think he's the Thorn of Istra, it's because the post says so. The girl claims you and your friends, including the Thorn, picked up her brother and her at some kind of crap tourist place.
Tana stared at the phone.
You can read it yourself if you want.
Jameson forked up some eggs.
But basically it says you survived a massacre where you met the Thorn. He didn't tell anyone who he was, but a brother figured it out at the gate when he saw a wanted sign. Let's just say lots of people were interested in her post.
Jameson's voice was neutral, his tattooed arms resting on the table. She studied them, words in large ornate script that disappeared under a white t-shirt, roses winding on green stems and moths of pale brown and white wings. Particularly... Lucien Moreau. She nearly choked on her eggs.
The vampire on TV?
Lucien Moreau. Pale gold hair and a face like a pre-Raphaelite painting. Ancient and ageless. He showed up during the quarantine, waltzing into the city, taking over the biggest house he could find and installing cameras everywhere. The parties that raged on in his house were as famous as the Eternal Ball, but more elegant and more deadly. You could watch them online and on certain late-night local channels, but no mainstream station would ever broadcast them unedited. Tana didn't watch, but Pearl and her friends did. She'd heard them whisper about what they'd seen, the blurry outlines of velvet capes, the tangled limbs, and Lucien, charming as ever, talking to you right through the camera. promising you with the curve of his mouth and the brightness of his eyes that no matter how loudly you screamed, you'd like whatever he did, and you'd never be the same once he was done.
I have a friend who lives in Lucian's house. She does errands and stuff for him. She was supposed to be keeping an eye on the gate. Apparently, ever since the thorn broke out of his prison in Paris, Lucian's been scared he's coming here.
Why? Tana forced herself to pick up the mug, ignoring her unsteady hands. She took a sip of coffee, the hot liquid steadying her enough to take a bite of the eggs. At the first taste, she realized she was hungrier than she'd imagined. Jameson leaned forward in his plastic seat. Lucian is the reason the thorn was locked up.
Apparently, your friend Gabriel let Casper Morales slip through his fingers. Lucian, or maybe Elizabeth, or probably both of them together, told some ancient vampire called the Spider what Gabriel had done, which is how the Thorn of Istra spent the last decade being tortured somewhere under the streets of Paris.
Tana thought about what Gabriel had said in the car after they'd left the gas station. The words had seemed nonsensical at the time, but now it seemed to Tana that they were a riddle.
This is the world I remade with my terrible mercy. An act of mercy that I regret. Endlessly. I regret it.
Tana's head was spinning again. How do you know all that?
I told you, he said. My friend lives with Lucian. Did the thorn say anything about what his plans were? Did he talk strategy?
I have a friend, too. And I mean to kill him.
There's somebody he wants dead.
Tana scraped a pile of eggs onto a tortilla and lifted it to her mouth. After the third bite and another swig from the mug, she started to feel a lot better.
I don't know anything other than that. I wouldn't have even believed that Gabriel was the Thorn of Istra if Winter hadn't shown me this.
She took the crumpled flyer from where she'd jammed it into her purse hours and hours before, unfolding it on the table, pressing out the creases. Seeing his black curls, the silver-topped cane, and the violence in his eyes. Tana was surprised all over again at the memory of his mouth's softness.
He didn't act like... I mean, he was terrifying, but he was weirdly kind, too. Not how you'd think.
Jameson peered over at the paper and whistled at the amount of the bounty.
How come you didn't turn him in at the gate?
Tana shook her head. He helped me out. That would be a pretty crappy way of paying him back. But I don't understand. Why would Lucian and Gabriel even know each other?
Lucian is Gabriel's maker, Jameson said.
What?
She couldn't imagine it.
Couldn't imagine Gabriel, whom she thought of as half the boy who'd promised her another day, and half the screaming creature underneath Père Lachaise Cemetery, having anything to do with slickster Lucian Moreau, who had sold licensing rights to his image so that posters of him could be sold at malls across the country.
Look, obviously I don't know much of anything. All I can tell you is that Gabriel's traveling alone, and there were some vampires hunting for him. He let us assume they were sent by the Thorn of Istra, but I guess they belong to the spider person.
The massacre Midnight mentioned in her post... That was because of them. A white thing streaked down from the sky, surprising Tana into nearly toppling off her chair. The crow spread its albino wings and alighted on the table, regarding her with its ruby eyes. It stalked across the plastic surface, cawing once and then picking at a few fallen curds of egg. Jameson started to laugh as the bird hopped up onto his shoulder. Flapping its wings, it flew up to his head.
This is Gremlin, he said, swatting the crow back to the table.
Tana put out her fingers tentatively and was surprised when the bird scampered over and rubbed its beak against her skin. She smiled a little, relaxing. There was something about an animal that made it hard not to feel like the person who kept it was basically decent.
Let me explain something about Cold Down, Jameson said. Mostly, we're an ecosystem that works.
The vampires need lots of living people to supply them with blood, willingly, through the shunts. If they had to go around attacking people, they'd risk spreading infection and losing their food supply. But when something shakes Cold Town up, we descend into chaos very quickly. Whether it's human terrorists breaking the windows of the Eternal Ball and setting themselves on fire, or turf wars between rival vampire gangs, things can get heated pretty fast. So if Gabriel's here to stir things up, there are a lot of vampires and humans who already hate Lucien and who would join him. She tried to imagine Gabriel's recruiting anybody and shook her head. I think whatever he's going to do, he'll be alone. He's not really... he's kind of crazy. Jameson looked faintly relieved. I'll tell my friend to try to get away from Lucien's for a few days, but I doubt she'll go. Tana took a last swig of the coffee, drinking down the grounds, feeling the caffeine sing through her blood. The sky above them had turned dark, and she thought of Aiden, back in the house, dead and risen, and waiting for her to return. Why is she with him in the first place if he's so awful? Jameson looked away from her. She's a vampire, he said quietly. The way he'd said it, as if he was embarrassed, made her wonder what it was like to have grown up here human. What did it mean to never have made the choice to come to Cold Town? To never want something from the vampires? What would he do for a marker like the one she'd lost? And how would he feel if he knew about the infection bubbling in her blood? Reaching over, Jameson stroked Gremlin's white feathers. Did you know that crows like to get the chemical in ant bites? Formic acid, I think. Anyway, they start to get so addicted to it that they'll spread out their wings on top of anthills. I think that she knows that Lucian's horrible, but she's gotten to like it. Tana shuddered at the image. Maybe she's just used to it. Maybe, Jameson said, but he didn't sound convinced. It's my turn to ask you something, she said. The thing about Jameson was that he seemed so oddly normal. Tough-looking, with a shadow of stubble over his jaw and the wiry muscles of someone who spent a lot of time climbing across rooftops. But he'd helped her, and hadn't asked for anything much in exchange. If you know a place where I can buy some stuff, like clothes and maybe a weapon, I'd love some directions. I didn't exactly come prepared. I know somebody with a pretty decent pawn shop. I could walk you over. Jameson raised both his eyebrows, waiting. Thanks again, she said, and he stood. Tonight she was going to have to find her way back to Aiden and retrieve her marker. And once she did, she was going to have to find herself a new prison, one where she could hole up and wait out the infection, with enough food and water and blankets to get her through 88 days of torment. 88 days, starting with this one. Chapter 22. One has to pay dearly for immortality. One has to die several times while one is still alive. Friedrich Nietzsche. The night that Gabriel was bitten for the first time, he woke to freshly starched sheets and an unfamiliar high-ceilinged room. He stank of liquor. Even his sweat smelled faintly of chartreuse, and he thought he might still be drunk. When he sat up, his head spun such that he had to lie back down. Outside the windows, the gas lamps of Paris burned beneath a moonless sky. "Drink this," a man's voice said, bringing a glass to his mouth. He gulped what turned out to be water. He felt odd, hot and cold at the same time, as though a fever was coming on. He was used to waking in filthy rooms, used to shame on the face of the person or persons who'd brought him there, used to walking back to his tiny apartment with a sour stomach and rumpled clothes in the late afternoon, scandalizing his landlord.
What he wasn't used to was finding himself in an opulent hotel with a blonde man standing over him wearing a wicked grin. Vaguely, he remembered a piano playing and a sting at his throat, as though a cobra had struck him, and some great pressure against his neck. But he'd spent most of the evening in one of the more raffish haute bohème salons, and while he'd heard it said that places like that were frequented by snakes, no one meant it literally.
I ought to go,
Gabriel said muzzily, trying to sit up again.
I'm not well.
Some sicknesses are worse than their cure, said the man, pinning Gabriel in place with the press of a single hand.
In the dim light, the irises of his eyes appeared to be spilled blood red. Gabriel stared up at him, too amazed to be afraid. After courting the devil's attention for so long, it seemed that at last the devil had come for him.
When it's done, we'll be like brothers, said the devil.
I already have a brother, Gabriel slurred. He's dead.
The devil loomed over him, his grin widening to show off sharp teeth.
As am I.
Gabriel opened his mouth to shout, but drunk as he was, he began to laugh instead. When Gabriel woke again, light was streaming through the window, making his memories of the night before seem ridiculous. A particularly silly and indulgent nightmare, brought on by too many drinks and too much misery. No man loomed over him ready to strike. No blood stained the bright white sheets. The hotel room was empty, his shirt and shoes resting on a nearby settee. On a low table, a fresh bottle of chartreuse was set out, beside a cut crystal glass and a plate of baked oysters. He blinked at the bed, at the rumpled sheets. He brushed fingers over his neck. They touched tender skin, as though he'd been bruised. That gave him pause, making him nervous enough to gather up his things and leave the room quickly, heading for home. He felt lightheaded as he made his way past the gambling dens and pawn shops that studded the 9th arrondissement around the Folies Bergère Music Hall. He walked inside a boucherie without even really deciding on it. There, he spent what meager coins he had on calf liver and ate it raw, straight off the brown paper in which it was wrapped, on the steps of his building. Gabriel slept through most of the day, waking at night with a creeping chill in his bones. Outside his apartment, he heard all the sounds of night in Paris, people hawking wares, whether food or flesh. Someone was playing dice in the back alley below his window. The sound of them on the cobblestones made him think of a skeleton rattling in its coffin. He found that he did not want to be alone. Fortunately, in Paris, he could find low company at any time. In a cabaret where a dark-haired girl performed the shocking Danse du Ventre, he met up with a few of his acquaintances. He knew little about any of them, really, except for their appetites, which were prodigious. Still, their laughter chased away the dreams of the night before, at least until Gabriel found himself studying the throat of Raoul de Clef, a comte's son, prone to gambling and deep in debt. As the night wore on, Gabriel became more and more aware of the movements of blood under de Clef's skin, of the way his heart sped it along, fresh and hot. It would be so easy to slice open flesh and release that red stream, bright as claret. It would be so easy to get him a loan, to promise him the loan of some money and then press him against the wall of the alley and... Gabriel pushed away the thought of what came next. He tried to watch the girl on stage, but when she rotated her hips, making the bells on her skirt tinkle, all he could think about was the artery that ran down the inside of her sweat-slicked inner thigh. He staggered home, drunk as he could make himself. When he opened the door to his room, a fire was burning in the grate, and the devil sat in a threadbare chair, as elegantly dressed in a dove-gray coat with covered buttons, as if he'd come straight from Versailles.
"I'm Lucien Moreau," the devil said, eyes bright with hellfire. "I imagine you have questions."
Gabriel stood in the doorway, frozen.
"I feel so strange," said Lucien in a falsetto,
a smile stretching his mouth, clearly much entertained by his own performance.
"What's happening to me? How could you make me have these terrible desires, Satan avant?"
Gabriel came inside, closing the door behind him.
"I apologize," he said. "I am very drunk and not likely to be as clever in my interrogation as you imagine. I confess I am discomposed, but you may stay as long as you please. I have been searching through the streets of Paris for damnation, and now that damnation has come to sit by my grate. Who am I to turn it away?"
He was not as cool as his words made him appear, but Lucien's mocking rendition of his thoughts had put him on his mettle. He refused to let the creature see how afraid he was. Lucien inclined his head in thanks.
"You never do quite what I expect. To me, surprise is a quality precious above rubies."
He held up his hand, and Gabriel could see that one of the silvery rings he wore covered the length of his finger like some kind of armor, with a wicked hooked talon at the end. He drew that across his wrist, letting blood well. It was darker than the blood Gabriel remembered spattering his brother's chest, darker and with an unusual blue tint. The smell of it seemed to fill the room, a hypnotizing scent, like ozone rising after a lightning strike, and he lurched forward without meaning to.
"Drink," Lucien said. "This is what you thirst for. Come and drink."
And as Gabriel bent his head, falling to his knees, fingers shaking as he closed them around Lucien's wrist, some part of him knew that before this moment, he had only been playing at wickedness. He had never done anything in Paris so terrible that he could not have returned to the man he had once been. Then the flavor of Lucien's blood washed over him and he was lost. He sucked at the wound, tongue pushing into the slit skin of Lucien's wrist, a low sound starting in the back of his throat. He forgot about Alexander. He forgot about his mother and father and sister. He forgot about the sound of the gun firing and the smell of the powder and the way his brother's body had sprawled in the snow. There was only this. And when he woke in the late morning, with blood staining his lips and teeth, blood smeared on the pillow where he'd rubbed his mouth against it in the night, all he thought of was getting more. Before, Gabriel had been full of self-loathing and conflicting desires, but now his days had a singular focus. He waited for night, and for Lucien to drink from him, and then feed him from his wrist. Nothing else mattered very much. He drifted through his days, no longer caring about salons or cabarets, no longer caring about drink or degradation. At first, the feedings exhausted him, but then the blood seemed to have worked some strange alchemy. His hunger abated. He walked through the streets during the day, feeling stronger, swifter, and more alert than ever before. He could snap a poker in half and catch the reins of a frightened horse, jerking it to a halt, without even exerting himself. In his room, alone, he threw a knife at the wall again and again, perfectly able to control where it struck. His canines grew longer and sharper, making his gums bleed. He was delighted, running his fingers over their points absently when he was alone, to prove to himself they were really there. And as Gabriel hunched over Lucien's wrist, new teeth making neat little holes in his skin, Gabriel felt as far from himself as he could have ever wished to be. On the seventh night, when Gabriel returned to his apartment just after dusk, Lucian